Save big on your landscaping project at Menards. We're your destination for concrete landscaping blocks. Whether you're installing a patio or adding a new retaining wall, we have the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Plus, get free estimates fast using our landscape design program in-store or on Menards.com. Save big on landscape blocks when you shop at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. So I planned to talk about habeas corpus this week because I'm terrified about Trump suspending it. And it's a thing I've been predicting and worried about for several months. But I started a book, and a few pages in, I knew we were going to talk about something else. We had to do something else. And I met our guest 12 and a half years ago when we were both speaking at a conference and warning about the threat of what we would come to describe as Christian nationalism. And when our paths crossed that first time, she was speaking about her first nonfiction book, The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. If you've not read this, you really need to go read it. We became fast friends. And as I was actually thinking about this episode, I dug up a picture of what was our first conversation, and I will share that on the socials. We've been at many conferences now. Catherine's second book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, rocked the socks off people, and it became the basis for the documentary God and Country, which Rob Reiner produced last year. And I can't believe it, but for more than a decade, we've leaned on each other. We've bounced ideas off each other. We've commiserated on the state of this country.
Andrew, I was so happy about that. It had such a really interesting mix of voices. And
It was an interesting mix. It was fun. Yeah. We've explored some of these big ideas over drinks, that's hopefully what people are going to be listening in on today. So if you have not figured it out yet, Catherine Stewart is here, folks. Catherine is a brilliant investigative journalist who's written for, I think, all the major outlets. She's a wonderful human being, a great friend, a phenomenal writer. Yeah. And now, I am so happy to be able to say this. This is the line that I've been waiting to deliver on this podcast. A New York Times best-selling author. Catherine Stewart, welcome to One Nation Indivisible.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's such a pleasure to be in conversation with you always. And look, 12, 13 years ago, were most people paying attention to the threats facing our democracy, even though we were warning about them? You know, we were seeing it, clear as day, and a lot of folks weren't paying attention. And now it seems like everybody is paying attention to sort of destruction of our democracy and its institutions is really undeniable. So There's progress on that front, at least, but we have a really hard road ahead.
We do have a hard road ahead, and I think a really great kind of roadmap for how we got to where we are is the new book, which I just devoured this week. And as I said, it derailed the podcast plans.
I'm sorry. I feel like I need to apologize. I've been
no, not at all. It derailed them in the best possible way. So the book is called Money, Lies, and God: Inside the Movement to Destroy American Democracy. First of all, amazing title. And it's not just an amazing title, but it's also sort of a method for kind of for categorizing this anti-democratic reactionary movement that we've been warning about. And I started reading, and to me, it was such a natural follow-on to the Good News Club and to the Power Worshippers. It's sort of like the culmination of this movement that we have been warning about for more than a decade. And just bear with me here for a minute, because this is also the 100th anniversary this summer of the Scopes Monkey trial. And as I was reading this, I was really reminded of like Charles Darwin traipsing around the Galapagos, and he's studying all these species and their adaptations and how they interact and rely on each other. And there were a few times when he came to mind as I was reading, because you're exposing this ecology of the reactionary right, these various strains of Christian nationalism. And you're often recounting these stories of visiting their spaces and interacting with the people at the various levels of the movement. And this is the fruit of that study and years of work. It's almost like it's your On the Origin of Species.
I've always felt like you really can't understand what's happening unless you're in the room where it's actually happening. This is a movement that, you know, you've got to pay attention to its strategists, not when they're invited onto CNN and, you know, coming up with their carefully massaged talking points for the average public, but when they're talking to one another and the spaces that they share. So over the past 16 years now that I've been researching this movement, I've spent a lot of time at right-wing strategy gatherings and conferences, Moms for Liberty groups, Reawaken America, some of the more hardline churches, trying to really understand how this movement functions and how there are these different factions that are actually exploiting one another, even and sometimes pursuing conflicting goals, but sort of swimming in the same headwaters, as it were. And so I sort of titled the book Money, Lies, and God, because first, money is a massive part of the story, meaning that huge concentrations of wealth at the very tippy top of the economic ladder have destabilized the political system in really interesting ways, affecting different factions of this movement differently. And we can sort of get into that a bit later. Lies, of course, because as you know, lies and conscious disinformation, conspiracism is another massive part of the anti-democratic movement. Really could not function without disinforming a large section of the electorate, and which makes them easier to control. And then third, of course, God, because religious nationalism is, I think, the most important ideological framework for the largest part of this movement. It really gets the rank and file on board. It's like a form of identity politics. You know, the radical right is always accusing the left of playing identity politics, but they play it harder. You're with us or you're against us. You're a true American or you're not. You're pure, you know, you're pure versus impure, an insider or an outsider. Because religious nationalism is a form of exclusionary nationalism. It's an idea of who gets to properly belong in the country and who doesn't.
Yeah, we're the true Americans, and everybody else is the other. And you know, the book really is a remarkable piece of investigative journalism. And the movement is so vast and so varied in a way, and it's so well funded you can see the amount of work, the years that it took for you to kind of fully explain this. Can you kind of get into the taxonomy of the movement a little, like how you categorize and label and arrange these various groups and players that seem at times to be opposed to each other. And we're definitely going to dig into that, because that's a theme of this podcast is finding the fault lines on the other side and exploiting them. But before we do that, like, can you kind of try to get your arms around the movement for the listeners?
Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a game of five card Monty, right? So I want to explain the categories. First, there's the funders. The massive increases in wealth inequality over the past five decades have really created a new class of authoritarian donors. Look, the Christian right always had donors, but the amounts of money have just ballooned as the wealth concentration at the tippy top has ballooned as well. Here's the interesting thing about these donors. They're not all evangelical. They're not all Protestant Christian. Some are Catholic, mm-hmm. some are Jewish, some are essentially nihilistic. They've essentially turned against democracy, and their anxieties, and I would say other limitations, make them easy marks for illiberal intellectuals and activists that are eager to use their money for the purposes. Some of them claim to want sort of, I would say, you know, religiously, they're all over the place, but they're united in this idea that regulation is always bad. They want, some of them say that they, you know, are pro-capitalist people. They just want to let the markets do their thing. But at the same time, they're seeking protective policies for their monopolistic businesses or taxpayer subsidies. I'm thinking about you, Mr. Elon Musk. So yeah. I would think about it, the fact that these folks are all sort of collaborating on an anti-democratic project. We can speak later about the fault lines there. Second category is the thinkers. So with the assistance of these donors, a new class of intellectuals has emerged and taken hold of much of the apparatus of the anti-democratic movement. Many of them are affiliated with the movement called the New Right. So it's essentially, I would say, less overtly religious nationalist and more overtly authoritarian. Some of these New Right affiliated folks like Russell Vogt, who is the head of Trump's Office of Management and Budget. And I read today that he's a new head of DOGE. He self-identifies as a Christian nationalist and has actually said he wants to infuse the government with as much Christian nationalism as possible. But other New Right thinkers really seem quite, I would say, more atheistic or fascistic and draw some of their most important ideas directly from thinkers tied to the Nazis, Nazi political theorist Carl Schmitt, for instance. So they explicitly favor rebelling against any government that's not headed by their movement. And they, in order to do that, you know, they say, argue democracy is a failed experiment. It won't give us what we need.
Yeah.
We long for a more monarchical form of government, a Red Caesar, sometimes as they express it, or a strongman, someone who will abandon the rule of law in favor of the iron fist. So that's the thinkers, the funders. Next, we have the sergeants. The movement, a sector of the Christian nationalist movement, are these pastoral networks. Movement leaders know very well that pastors are often the most trusted voices in their communities. And if you can get the pastors, you can get their congregants. So they have drawn these pastors into networks with names like Faith Wins and Watchmen on the Wall and Church United, and there are other networks. And they give them these very explicit tools for turning out their congregants to vote for their supposedly biblical values, which all inevitably reduced to same-sex marriage and abortion and some of the other culture war issues they're using to, you know, control people's votes. So these very hyper-political pastors are, I call them sergeants, and they're cultivated by super wealthy donors and leaders of the Christian nationalist movement. These groups,
and they've got the built-in organization because the churches exist all over. So it's, yeah. And their people are going there every Sunday.
Many of these churches have been essentially converted into partisan political cells. And these groups take their instruction from higher level leaders, but are organized again into cells or units. The power players are those higher level leaders. They're the national level activists or strategists who raise funds, set the agenda, organize, get out the vote efforts at a national level, run media operations, and either lend or withdraw support from politicians in order to advance the Christian nationalist agenda. Just to throw out a few names here, by no means comprehensive, I'm thinking about people like Bob McEwen or Ralph Reed or Tony Perkins, head of these organizations. Then you've got, finally, number five, the foot soldiers, the rank and file. Many analyses of the Christian nationalist movement put the rank and file of the movement first and define the movement in terms of sort of the ideas and affinities of this particular group. But I argue that they're more often manipulated by the other actors into supporting an anti-democratic agenda. I would say the largest percentage of the foot soldiers consists of white evangelicals, but other segments are growing. And the group as a whole is increasingly diverse, both religiously and also ethnically.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And I just want to say, too, you have been, I think, one of the few observers who has been careful to point out that Christian nationalism and the broader reactionary right is a top-down movement and not this sort of grassroots movement that it purports to be and that the media sometimes treat it like. You've been very good about that. And I want to drill down for a second on the funders and the thinkers, because your book did a remarkably good job of explaining the funders in a way that I think nobody has quite yet nailed down. And then I loved the way that you connected them to the thinkers. And you often talked about how this movement is affirmative action for these conservative, straight, white Christian men, right? For these right-wing reactionaries, basically for conservative men with bad ideas. And these men, and they're nearly all men, as you point out, you know, that they cosplay like these intellectuals who are well-versed in Plato and with the founders, and they have these brilliant regressive ideas. But the only reason that they are not, you know, like hawking pencils from a cup on a street corner is because they've got these billionaires who are putting all of this money behind their bad ideas. So they're not participating in the marketplace of ideas that they revere. They're hacking the marketplace by using these billionaires who are in turn using them.
That's true. They all have something that I'm increasingly calling anti-woke derangement syndrome. Right.
They are very obsessed with something that they can't define.
I mean, it's like when somebody says the grading system at the school is so unfair, I have no choice but to plant a bomb underneath the school. Right. Or, oh, you know, I have to, you know, it's basically using this idea, not just actual what they consider like overreach of progressivism, but also the idea that somebody somewhere might have possibly had a bad idea about a conservative straight white man. That becomes the excuse to burn the whole system down. You know, I refer to these people as reactionary nihilists because they're better defined, I think, by what they want to destroy than what they want to create. When they talk about what they want to destroy, it's very clear they hate the woke, the, you know, DEI. Basically, that's a form of this old Jim Crow mentality in a new guise. We think about, you know, they're very hostile to women's equality. If you really drill down on some of the think tanks like the Claremont Institute and the stuff they're sort of contributors who are New Right affiliated publish about women, it's abhorrent. I mean, but some of that stuff is the hardest part of the book.
It really is.
Because you really have to read the most kind of grotesque rank misogyny, and they're really swimming in it, you know? But what is it that they're really resentful of? Well, the idea of equality, the idea of pluralism, the idea they might not, just by virtue of what they are, that they might have to kind of share in an actual meritocracy. But I think of a lot of these New Right folks as like funder whisperers. You know, they play a really important role.
Interesting, yeah.
Telling the funders where to send their money.
And so much of what they're pushing out, I mean, it's such obvious bullshit and so full of that disinformation that we were touching on a moment ago. And there was a line at the end of chapter 7 where you're quoting Plato back at these guys who love to quote Plato, basically. And you know, you write, if your power depends on lying to people, you must either accept it or embrace the lie. You must accept that you're a fraud or embrace the lie. And I loved this so much for its writing, because you're using Plato. Catherine Stewart is using Plato against these men who love nothing more than to cosplay as philosophers. It was this rhetorical roundhouse, and it was a beautiful way to end it. And actually, I just want to, you use Hamilton in The Room Where It Happened, but this reminded me of another line of Hamilton where he raps about Socrates throwing verbal rocks at these mediocrities. These men were just so outgunned when it comes to the skill with the written word and intellect when they're up against you. And it was a beautiful thing to see. And the other thing I was curious about was there's this big group of the funders and the folks who are, they're what people would call Nepo babies today, right? They're the beneficiaries of this accumulated generational wealth, right? Like Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump, I mean, Elon Musk, you know, comes from the family's emerald mine in apartheid South Africa, mm-hmm. and so many others. The funding was such a big and revealing part of this book. You know, it was kind of always looming there in the background, and it's a thing that you've done such a good job of exposing here. And I wonder if that is a thread that you've come back to and think about, this generational wealth aspect of it.
I do to some extent. It's very interesting that, you know, the movement does draw on a lot of folks who benefit from generational wealth, although not exclusively. I mean, some of the mm-hmm. folks in the movement actually have humble beginnings, but they're basically united in using this sort of hostility to equality and, quote, the woke as a pretext for nihilistic fantasy. I mean, when this kind of thing was just fodder for fringy podcasts, it seemed kind of good for a laugh, but now it's controlling all the levers of power in our federal government. It's really not funny anymore. I mean, what they're doing is using this excuse to take a sledgehammer to vital government services, to our national security apparatus, to our economy, to the scientific establishment that has frankly made us the envy of the world and been a huge generator of economic growth and security in our country. The only explanation for all of this that they can provide is, again, that they think someone somewhere might have said something bad about a conservative straight white man. So this is kind of anti-woke derangement syndrome in action. And since, you know, you mentioned Darwin in the very beginning, I think we really have to talk about the war on science. It's really foremost in my mind because, first of all, it's grotesque and baffling to a lot of people because they're taking a sledgehammer. They're like throwing our scientific establishment into the wood chipper. And for what reason? And that's, a lot of people can't understand that. But I think it speaks to something really fundamental about this movement, which is that science relies on sort of rational processes and rational thinking. And this is a movement that understands that the truth is their enemy because the truth and facts are inimical to dictatorial power. I mean, so just think about it. You know, what kind of administration guts the scientific research apparatus that's grounded our economic strength and made us the envy of the world, right? They're destroying the agencies that handle food safety, approve new medications. They're firing people who handle nuclear codes. I don't know if you've been paying attention to air traffic safety recently.
Oh, I am not a scared flyer, but I am terrified to fly lately. I truly am. Like, it never bothers me. Every time I board a plane, though, I'm thinking like, and I'm texting my family, I'm like, you know, I really love all of you in case you don't hear from me on the other end of this flight.
Oh, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. I mean, you know, can we even fly through Newark anymore? Listen, and here's the irony is that a subset of, look, America's a lot of very wealthy people. It's only a subset who are funding this movement. But that subset who are bankrolling the authoritarian movement, frankly, a lot of them made their money thanks to advances in science and technology, and particularly from government-funded science. So the attacks on science and the scientific establishment are sort of part of the attack on universities, part of the attack on what they call a woke elite or an establishment. There isn't one single driving cause of this war on science. I think the war on the truth is one cause. But I also think a sort of that reactionary nihilism, this idea that we just need to destroy the sort of, you know, woke elite apparatus that Russell Vogt is always talking about, the war on science is kind of collateral damage from that war on universities. So there's that's part of it. But I think the other part of it has to do with the fact that, the scientific system they see as antithetical to their political goals. And so, you know, the Christian nationalist movement has long believed that science has been turned into a weapon against their faith. They believe that climate science is not just a hoax, but also a secular plot to undermine their religion in particular. In fact, sometimes you got, you know, about the Cornwall Alliance and the sort of green dragon, meaning, you know, idea that, you know, anything climate related or environmentalism related is literally satanic. But then I think that there's a more sort of Schmidtian Nazi inspired perspective coming from people in the Claremont orbit, which hold that science has become part of a woke bureaucracy, that it's intent on pushing undesirable social views and cutting off genuine opportunities for a leader of, quote, the people, like the Red Caesar. So people like Russell Vogt see science as evil bureaucracy, and they simply want to destroy it. And here's the thing, when I call these people reactionary nihilists, because, you know, they know what they want to destroy, but when they want to talk, what they talk about, when they talk about what they want to create, it's always some version, like an imaginary version of a fantasy of the past that never existed, the way they think
it did, great again.
But includes like deeply reactionary elements, you know, a very strict gender order, the idea of sort of correct religion and everybody else has to obey. Some people are entitled to rule, others are required to conform, et cetera.
Yeah, it's rolling back all that progress.
I know.
That has allowed others to attain any measure of equality. And it really was striking, and you did an excellent job, I thought, of pulling that thread throughout the book of how one of the reasons they are attacking, one of the rationales for attacking science and democracy and all of these things is because that it in a way, my words, not yours, they can't stand up to that rational debate. Their ideas can't withstand it. It can't withstand reason. You know, you come back repeatedly at the beginning and throughout the book and in the end to the idea of reason and that being a prerequisite for democracy. And that in a way, that's a lot of what they're going after. And I want to, you touched on something there with some of these folks making their billions off of the existence of science and the furthering of science in this country. And that's sort of one of a contradiction, but I want to explore the fault lines now and the divisions that we're seeing. And I think first, let's do it in two ways. First, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about how they try to divide us. And then I want to look at the fault lines on their side, how they've ignored them and how we might exploit them. So can you tell us first about, there's been some deliberate attempts, for instance, by, you know, Russian troll farms to draw left-leaning Americans into these polarized positions that divide the country. Can you kind of lay that out for folks a little bit?
Absolutely. And thank you for asking, because I think we need to get smarter in general about when they're attempting to divide us and not allow ourselves to get backed into taking unpopular positions, instead sort of pivoting and saying, you want us to talk about this because you don't want us talking about that. Listen, I have a whole section in Money, Lies, and God about this. There have been Russian troll farms, but, you know, plenty of actors on the right, of course, who take people with incredibly polarizing voices or find really polarizing views and try and make an issue that's sort of a side issue, the issue of the day. So, like, you know, for instance, you know, when I went to America Fest, which was a Turning Point USA's annual conference in Phoenix, Arizona, I attended this last December. There are 20,000 hardcore MAGA supporters there. And look, America faces a lot of issues. We've got a lot of people struggling to afford a place to live. People, you've got two parents, you got four jobs. They still can't afford a decent life for their children. Healthcare has become inaccessible and unaffordable for a lot of folks. We have instances of genuine corruption right now in our politics. Gun violence.
Unbelievable corruption.
I know. And we could
we should
return to that, because I think that's really important to drill down and help people understand. But, you know, gun violence is the number one cause of death among children and adolescents in our country. So what do you think that three quarters of the speakers spoke about? The 10 ACE NCA out of 520,000 NCAA, that's National College Athletics Association, athletes, student athletes, the head of the NCAA said, I think there are fewer than 10 trans-identified student athletes. Okay, so whatever you or I might think about that issue, is this worth the billions of words and millions, likely millions of votes that it collected? Absolutely not. It's not an issue that affects the majority of Americans, but yet the right wants to litigate this issue over and over and take a position that many, if not most, Democrats or liberals may not agree with, but characterize the entire, anybody who is not on board with their agenda as being, you know, embracing the most sort of, you know, one particular position on this particular issue. So that's
kind of- Is it fair to say that this is not, right? They're not stumbling across this issue. They're looking at the data and the polling, and they're saying, this is the issue that will divide the other side.
It's also
find somebody that we can lift up.
Well, it's also the way that they try to pretend they're defending women as they're taking away women's most essential rights. And by the way, a majority of Americans, including majority of Republican voters, support abortion rights in some form, because most of us know that if you take away not just the right to abortion, it's going to take away people's choice and families' choice about their most intimate and impactful decisions, but it will also make all pregnancy unsafe. You know, one out of every four or five known pregnancies ends in miscarriage, and large numbers of those need medical intervention in order to complete the miscarriage safely. I'm one of the many, many, many women in our country who needed an abortion to save my life when a miscarriage went wrong and I was bleeding out. And I don't want to talk about the details of what happened right now. I will say that it happened in a Catholic hospital, and I didn't get my miscarriage that I needed, my abortion I needed to save my life until I lost 40% of my blood and nearly died. And my story is hardly the worst story. I mean, I'm really lucky to be alive after that experience. And so many women have worse stories than mine. ProPublica has done a pretty good job of documenting a lot of the deaths that are a consequence of these abortion bans across all these red states. A lot of women are damaged, they're organ damaged. I spoke to one doctor who was telling me like story after story, told me about one young mom who, you know, her miscarriage care was delayed so long that she ended up with acute sepsis, organ failure, and she survived, but she was already a mom and one kid, and she ended up living in a long-term care facility. Because the first hospital she went to, which was a Catholic hospital, was unwilling to complete the abortion that she needed to save her life. Now, who does that serve? The right is inflicting all of this misery and death and destruction and despair on American women, but they need a narrative. They need to say, oh, we stand for women's rights. So they choose this side issue that affects very few people in order to do that. So that's, you know, that's one way that they try to divide us. And I think that, you know, there are other issues that they are using to divide us because, well, first of all, I think of those sort of the sexuality issues as like the laser pointer cat toys. You know, that do you have a cat? You have like a little thing which puts a little red dot on the floor and the cat jumps at it. So anything that has to do with sexuality or gender identity, whatever, everybody looks because, you know, we just do. But then it prohibits a lot of folks from being able to see the bigger picture and to recognize when they're trying to divide us on these issues. So my thing is like, whatever you or I think about that issue doesn't matter so much as much as the fact that they are trying to divide us. And also they're scapegoating. And every fascistic movement needs a scapegoat. But they never end with a scapegoat. So that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, and I just wanted to be clear on that. You're not talking about the merits of any of those issues. You're saying that they are effectively distracting, dividing, and really, I mean, winning political power by lifting those issues up.
Exactly.
So, and abortion is one of the ways that they did the kind of the opposite for their own side, right? It became this unifying message that helped sort of plaster over these pretty significant differences. And you spend a lot of paper, rightfully, I think, exploring how those sectarian lines that had divided religions, especially Catholics and Protestants, you have a great chapter on Catholics, have sort of fallen away in favor of this pursuit of the destruction of American democracy, right? Abortion as their unifying issue and as a wedge that they used against the rest of the country. So what are the fault lines in their movement? What are the cracks that we could drive a wedge into?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, the most obvious wedge, I would say, is between the agenda of the funders, who are like uber, uber wealthy, and the agenda of the rank and file. Because when you strip away the religious nationalism from the rank and file, they really want a better deal for themselves and for the workforce, right? A lot of their resentments have to do with the fact that, again, over five decades, don't take my word for it, just look at the economic data. Massive concentrations of wealth at the very top have made life more difficult for most American families. So a lot of these members of the rank and file, they do have legitimate grievances, but instead of like being directed to the source of those grievances, they're instead being misdirected to, you know, blame a trans woman over here or an uppity feminist who's not staying in her lane over there, or blame the people of color who are diversifying your neighborhood, right? So they have been told to scapegoat the others, or, you know, the non-believers or the non-religious, et cetera. As a source of their problems, when those aren't the real sources of their problems. The real source of their problem has to do with, you know, decades of hard right economic ideology that's actually stripped away rights for the workforce, degraded life for ordinary Americans. Again, this is a movement that claims to stand for the American family, but it's driving support for politicians whose policies are making it so much harder for so many American families to succeed. So you've got the agenda of the rank and file, who really do want and would benefit from a better deal for themselves and for the workforce. And then the agenda of the funders, who are really just looking for a better deal for themselves, not just to increase their massive wealth, but also to justify the massive increases. I think there's a psychological aspect here, Andrew, because I think those folks, they live almost like on islands where they're surrounded by yes.
Oh, yeah.
If you're rich to that degree, you know, I think a lot of people don't know that, you know, how rich these people really are. So they're surrounded by yes people all the time, being told how wonderful they are. They're masters of the universe. They should control everything. And yet they can kind of somewhere like over the hills or over the walls of their islands, they can hear the criticism of those who are saying, wait, maybe you should be paying same taxes as a school teacher, or maybe you should be paying your workforce a little better, sort of, and saying what you're doing isn't actually great for our society. And they don't like that. It's almost like a narcissistic injury. So the gravity,
I think you're right about that.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. It seems like at some point that kind of wealth and or maybe power, right? It almost starts to pickle the brain. Like, and Elon Musk and Doge is I think a relevant example right now, right? Like, this is a guy who's like, I can come in and cut all this, but, and it turns out, no, you can't. You have no idea what you're doing. You're not good at it. You're not doing what you said you were going to do. You're failing, utterly failing. I mean, Betsy DeVos, and like, I can come in and fix education. No, you can't. You don't know what you're doing. And instead they're, you know, I was really intrigued by this, and it's probably the thing. I mean, I finished the book last night, but it's the thing that I've been thinking about the most. It's this wedge, right? Because the problem America faces is not people who don't look like you, or people who don't love like you, or people who don't worship like you. The problem is the ultra wealthy, for whom too much is never enough, and who have accumulated literally now trillions of dollars by convincing you and anybody that anybody and everybody but them is the problem. Thanks for listening to the free version of today's episode. To get the whole conversation, unfiltered and unfettered, sign up at accessmundi.us. costs less than that latte you bought on the way to work, and I am just as delicious. Signing up also gets you premium content from Straight White American Jesus and other Access Mundi shows. Try it. You can always change your mind because life is too good to waste on bad ideas. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Spring into big savings on all Larson storm doors now at Menards. Larson doors are perfect to enjoy the fresh spring air. Whether you're looking for additional security or a screen door, we have what you need. They come in over 40 styles and 9 colors to choose from. Check out all Larson storm door options in store and find more great deals in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save.